Well, you all quiet up real good. I mean, I thank you very much for coming. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS. I have the privilege of opening up our session today. I tell people that I have the one essential quality to run a think tank, and that's my superficiality. I can drop in on any meeting and get it started, but I have absolutely no substance, you know. And so I have the luxury of being able to open things up and welcome people and to get things going. I must tell you, when we first started working with the National Petroleum Council, Marshall, you and John and everybody, thank you very much. When we first started working with the National Petroleum Council, or at least contemplated it, Frank Verastro warned me, you don't want to do this. He said, you have no idea how intensive these NPC studies are. And I was used to thinking, you know, maybe more along the scale of where we do studies, and I have never experienced anything quite like this. It was the most intensive, deliberative, expansive study effort I have ever experienced. And you're looking at five, six people here who were, I call the six horsemen of the apocalypse. I mean, they delivered this thing, you know. And they were more instrumental in pulling together this study than anyone else. I should say Alan Kelly, who's not with us today, but should be with us today, was also the lead horseman. And this was a remarkable effort. I think we had over 1,000 people who got engaged in this effort. Now, of course, you get 1,000 people in Washington, and that's enough for a riot. It's but it also to bring it together and coordinate it and have it produce coherent results depends on people like these gents here who help make it possible. I think what was for me remarkable was that this was a time when people got together, they argued intensely with each other. They listened to each other, and I saw it change people's minds. And that's what you want in a policy deliberation in Washington. And you've seen that in this product. This is really quite a good study. And I think it offers tangible directions for the country. I mean, we're in a town where people substitute strategy for slogans, and they use slogans as though they were strategies. And, you know, this is what you're seeing here really is a strategy. You could do this stuff, and it would make a difference. And it was produced by these gentlemen that are here and ladies that were also participants with us in this conference. So I want to commend them for what I think is exceptional work. I want to thank Frank for putting up with me as I forced him into this effort, and my really amazing admiration for all of them for having done this work. Thank you all for coming. You know, you can do a study and launch it off into the wilderness, but it isn't until it engages the intellects in Washington that have their own issues, their own interests, their own agendas. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's frankly what Washington's about. But it then needs to be brought together and people need to hammer it. I mean, you know, ideas in Washington's like a smithing forge. You got to put it on an anvil and bang on it for a while, you know, and that's what we're going to do today. We're going to take this study and we're going to open it up and people are going to hammer it for a while, but it's all for the better, and I think it's going to be great. So, Frank, are you going to start us for real? Sure. Why don't I turn it over to you, and let me again say thank you to you gents, and I really am very grateful for everything that you did on this. I was proud to be associated with you. Frank, let me turn it to you.
Thanks, John. Thank you, and good morning. Let me add my welcome to John's. This was an interesting study. It took us over a year and a half to put it together, and since we're the home team here, we're at CSIS, I need to point out that there was a number of our regional scholars and program scholars and staff that really helped with this, and in particular, we need to identify Sarah Ladislaw, Jennifer Bovair, John Schaus, and Ed Chow, because without them, we wouldn't have been able to pull this off. John Guy and Marshall Nichols from the NPC are in the front row here, and without their help, I don't think we would have had a manageable or readable report. Although some people can argue with the size, it's daunting. This morning, since many of you have already seen at least the summary reports on this study, we thought that we need to start diving down deeper into the study, and the group we've assembled for you this morning really are the folks that put it together. We had responsibility for geopolitics and policy, but the other folks on the podium, Jim Slutz, will be our first speaker, is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy for Fossil Energy. He served as the government co-chair. Bill Finger is a senior associate with CIRA. He ran most of the demand activities. Jim Burkhart wasn't able to join us. He was the chair of the demand task group. Don, excuse me. Okay. Don Paul is a senior vice president and chief technology officer with Chevron. He ran the supply group and also did most of the endowment work. Rod Nelson is a vice president for Schlumberger for marketing research. He ran technology and carbon management, and we're going to split them up in terms of discussing the issues and findings that we brought together. And Adam Siminski worked on parallel studies. Adam's going to talk about the recommendation. Adam was also on the integration task group, on the policy task group, and collectively this group made up a lot of the coordinating subcommittee. This would be a good time, in out of courtesy to both the people around you and the speakers at the table, if you've got cell phones, if you can mute them at this point or turn them off, that would be helpful. We're going to try to limit the presentations to 10 to 12 minutes each, if we can do that, so that we can allow ample time for questions and answers. And we'd really like to have a discussion. So if you've got specific items you want to raise, this would be a great time to do it, because this is the group that you want to talk to. And thank you very much for coming. Jim, all yours.
Thank you, Frank. And in the interest, I'm going to move through some of this stuff very quickly, since my understanding is many are have seen some of the front-end information. But it is important for those of you that haven't had the benefit of a couple of background slides that I'll take a couple minutes. But I'll try to do far better than 10 minutes, far shorter. First, before we start, a couple things that I think are important. Just a couple quick introductions. Marshall Nichols and John Guy are sitting over here. Marshall is the executive director of the National Petroleum Council, and John is the deputy executive director. And obviously, this type of effort isn't done without a very competent professional staff at the NPC. So I want to acknowledge them. Let me also, very quickly, it's important that you understand who the National Petroleum Council is. They are an advisory committee to the Secretary of Energy. And they exist to give advice to the Secretary and only do reports at the request of the Secretary. So it is, and it's governed under the Federal Advisory Committee Act. So that's the real quick information, but that is very important for you to understand. The report itself, if you actually have printed it out, this is what it is, two-sided. It takes almost a ream of paper to do. And on that note, within another few weeks, the actual very nice printed volumes will be available sometime in mid-September. I'll add that little logistics thing. So if you want to use it electronically and avoid consuming, we in the energy department, we're trying to avoid consuming vast amounts of forests with this. Okay. So in the fall of 2005, the Secretary requested the National Petroleum Council take on this study, and he posed these three questions. He didn't limit the council, but wanted to kind of pose some framework for the study. And obviously, you can't look at oil and gas without looking at other energy resources, so that's the nature of what brought it into a much broader framework than just oil and gas. This is the just to give you an overall sense of the leadership of the study, and many of you are familiar have seen this. I might add that I've been involved in a few different NPC studies, and another item that we haven't talked about that differentiates this in some ways is the participation of the executive leadership team. Participated on a very routine basis for many hours of meetings. Now, just give an overall framework of the layout of the study. It's not uncommon in an NPC study to have a supply and demand component and set up a team. But one of the unique characteristics of this was to set up a technology team and a geopolitics and policy team to look much broader into these cross-cutting issues. And what emerged from that is this: the other issues that were identified in that process were things that were key drivers were economics, environment, and energy security. And as you look at it, many of them, the policy recommendations looked at those issues. And one of the areas that differentiated this study was the desire to try to address all three rather than just one or two of those. So let's just very briefly, a couple things that's different was, one is this was not a new supply and demand forecast. but really looked at the available information out there and what made that different. So over 100 studies were reviewed and analyzed, including both publicly available and proprietary. Diverse set of expertise. There were 350 participants in the various work groups, and then through the outreach, John mentioned 1,000 people. There was another 1,000 people engaged for ideas, input, and various direction early in the study. And then another key differentiating factor was the role that technology assessment played. And very, very more, about half of the 350 people were involved in various technology groups. And each within that, there were, and Rod will cover that, but many, many different subgroups that did detailed papers. And underneath this, which will also, when it's published, be available on CD-ROM, are a set of 30 or 31 working papers that are not approved as part of the report, but are input into it. And again, the diversity was mentioned. I mentioned before in the last slide, but this gives you a sense. 65% of the participants were outside of the oil and gas industry. So, with that kind of just very brief intro, I'm going to turn this over to Bill Finger to take you through the demand section.
Thank you, Jim. Looking across the room, I see many people I've known over over many years and in different aspects of this. It's good to see you all again. As Jim mentioned, this was an interesting study. It was a different study in that the NPC staff actually took work of others and looked at them in the context of what the future energy situation might be for the U.S. and for the world. And as Jim has indicated, pretty rapidly it turned out that energy, of course, is a worldwide issue, and the world became much of the focus of what was done. What are the hard truths as far as demand is concerned? And these are the principal ones. As we get to the end of the demand section, we'll talk more about some of the specific ones. But basically, most of the projections that are out there suggest that the demand for energy is going to increase 50 or 60% over the next 25 years. And we'll talk more about population and improving living standards, which is primarily measured by income, gross domestic product, however you want to look at that kind of number. And on the other side, it basically says that coal, oil, natural gas will continue to remain, as it has been in the past, the significant parts of the supply for this energy in the future. I thought I would show you this particular chart. This is an interesting chart in that it goes back from 1980, goes to 2030, and shows a rather simple projection of history and projection of what energy has been and will be. And it highlights from the demand side some of the issues that were faced. First of all, finding projections into the future that are detailed enough and integrated enough to use as credible kinds of foundations for making any kind of discussion or points on demand is not easy. There are really two major organizations that we came across that do worldwide projections where there is an interrelationship between supply, demand, and the various consuming sectors. One is the Energy Information Administration from the Department of Energy here in the U.S., and the other is the International Energy Agency. So from the demand side, this is basically what we talk about. Now, that's not to say that all other projections were ignored or eliminated or not used. As Jim mentioned, there were 100 and some odd other projections that were evaluated and compared with these. And interestingly enough, they basically fell within the range of what we have shown on this particular chart. So rather than confuse everybody with 100 different lines on the chart, we thought we would reduce it to 5 or 6, which is confusing enough. The 50 or 60% number is not a surprising number, because if you go back the past 25 years, back to 1980, the last quarter of a century that's on this chart, the growth in energy demand in the world was also 60%. So we've got 60% in the past, 60% in the future. What is different, of course, is the absolute level of increase. 60% of a bigger number is a bigger number. So this provides the supply side, which you will hear a great deal about in a moment, with a significant challenge as to how this will be met. Not shown on here is the U.S. Side. The U.S. growth in energy demand is not like 60%. It's more in the range of 25% in these projections. Which is not particularly different from what happened over the last quarter of a century in the U.S. This chart deals with the various fuels, and again, there doesn't appear to be anything terribly exciting in that the fact that all of the fuels, the fossil fuels, pretty much grow as they have grown in the past. Gas grows at a slower rate than it did in the past. Coal about the same, and oil about the same. And we'll see a share chart in a moment, and as you can anticipate, this makes a difference in the share. What is interesting is that if you take a look at oil, and much of the focus of this study was on oil, if you take a look at oil and you go back to 1980, there was about 65 million barrels a day of oil used in the world. Today, the number is in the mid-80s. And these outlooks, if we stick with the non-policy kind of outlooks and the low economic growth outlooks, have a demand in 2030 at roughly 110 to 120 million barrels a day. Now, this is a significant increase from today's level, and again, the ability to meet that in the future is something that will be discussed in detail as we proceed. Gas gets to 150 or so, 150, 185 trillion cubic feet, up from 103 now. So it is also a major growing source of energy in the future. As suggested, what does this mean as far as the share of fuels that are to be used in the future as projected by these outlooks? And basically, as far as the fossil part of the supply is concerned, things don't change very much in the projections that are out there. Roughly 81% of the energy supplied in 2004 is what's shown on this chart is oil, oil, gas, and coal. The same thing is true in 2030. Interestingly enough, if you go back to 1980, it was a higher share. And the major change between 1980 and 2004 was a significant introduction of the use of nuclear energy into the world mix of energy supply. And that drove fossil fuel use down from the 89% that's shown on this chart to the 81% we see now. Tied to all of this, and more will be said about it, is the issue of carbon. This chart depicts carbon emissions in the world. It's not surprising that carbon emissions are tied very closely to energy use. Historically being 1980, there were about 18 billion tons, metric tons of carbon dioxide emitted. In 2005, this has grown to 27. If you look at the projections into the future, if you look only at the reference cases, it's 40 to 44 billion tons of carbon dioxide. And the range is 44 to 51. Now, I'd like to say a little bit about the 44, which is the low end on the chart. And I haven't said anything about that particular case because that particular case is the International Energy Agency's alternative policy case, and that is the one unique case that we found in all of the cases that that we looked at that deals really with the impact of policy on the use of energy and ultimately the emissions of carbon dioxide. What the International Energy Agency did, the IEA did, was they went out and looked at all of the policies that were on the books in the world, not actually in place but were being looked at, and evaluated the total impact of that future on carbon dioxide and other things, but in this case carbon dioxide. And what it did for the IEA was reduced their CO2 emissions from 40 billion metric tons to the low end of this scale, which is 34 billion. There were 1,400 policies that they evaluated, which is a significant, not only in the U.S., of course, this is worldwide, which is a significant policy effort. So overall, what does this mean as far as the observations that one gets from the demand side? Well, first of all, when you begin to look at history and you look at the future, the thing that's obvious in all of these that always falls out is that income, generally expressed as gross domestic product, and population are the two major drivers for energy consumption, the first being a measure of wealth, of convenience, of desire for a better standard of living. And interestingly enough, these particular projections have the growth in income at about the same rate in the next quarter of a century as they as occurred in the last quarter of a century, roughly 3.3 to 3.5% per year. Population, on the other hand, is a slightly different issue. Over the last quarter of a century, world population grew at about 1.5% per year. The projections that basically everybody used, which is the UN projection for population, has population growing at about 1% per year for the next 25 years. So that was a mitigating factor on demand, but of course wealth or improvement in living standard was a positive impact on demand growth. Energy efficiency is abounds in all of these outlooks, and I'll talk a little bit more about energy intensity in a moment, but basically the premise in the projections is that the intrusion movement towards more energy efficient use of energy will be the same in the future pretty much as it has been in the past. That is with the exception of the alternative policy case where there is a move towards more efficient energy use, but it still does not take the growth out of demand. CO2 emissions, as we've already mentioned, are tied very closely to the growth in demand for energy, and one of the reasons is the reason that we expressed earlier, and that is that energy demand is supplied by fossil fuels, and fossil fuels, by the nature of the way they're consumed, do produce carbon dioxide. Fossil fuels remain the largest share, and yes, fossil fuels, as we've shown, are. And finally, on this particular chart, while we haven't shown any charts, the mix of use of energy changes in the world. The industrialized world consumes less of the energy. The emerging economies, particularly Asia, grow in the use of energy into the future. Transportation is the largest component of oil demand growth in the U.S. and the world. Basically, in the U.S., transportation now consumes 67% of the oil barrel. In these projections, it grows to 71%. In the world, the comparable numbers are 51 and 55%. So transportation becomes the major factor as far as oil consumption is concerned. Nuclear energy in the projections is not a significant growth energy. As a matter of fact, in all of the projections except for the alternative case, the percentage of nuclear power decreases, not significantly, but from 6% to 5% of the total. Energy intensities continue to decline, which is a recognition or a reflection of the fact that energy is being used more efficiently, and to some extent the economies are changing towards a more service-oriented future than what we've had in the past. And finally, global and U.S. per capita use of energy increases. The U.S. doesn't increase very much, but it still remains the most energy-intensive user of society in the world, even as we get out to 2030. So the U.S. is still the largest consumer of energy per capita in the future. With that, I think it will be an interesting time to move on to Don Paul, and he will talk about how these demands will be met.
Well, thank you, Bill, and good morning, everyone. And I'd like to shift gears a bit and talk about the supply study and the just a couple of comments. When we started the study, the questions were about oil and gas, but it became very clear that societies really run on fuel and power. And as one looks out over an extended period of time, like 25 years, there were going to be, in fact, you see them today, diversification in the ways to make fuel and power, and therefore we decided we had to look at the whole system and then see oil and gas in that context. And I think I'll show you some things this morning that I think have strongly validated that approach, although obviously we did look at oil and gas specifically as well. So if we could bring up the hard truth, and I'm going to just quoted, we thought long and hard about the specific words and then get into a couple of elements of it that are, of course, discussed at great length. One is that the world is not running out of energy resources, and I'll talk about that some more in a minute, but there are accumulating risks to continuing expansion of oil and natural gas production from the conventional sources relied upon historically. These risks create significant challenges to meeting the projected total energy demand. This ties directly to what Bill just said, that the historical growth rates and demands for energy that are forecasted by many on the demand side typically call on significant continued growth in supply from the traditional resources, which are conventional oil and gas, coal, although there's obviously a mix of other energy sources as well. One of the questions that came up in the study is, what's the size of the resource base? And this is a point, of course, of significant contention and a significant amount of geologic uncertainty. That assessing, for example, the total oil resource base has been an activity that the U.S. Geological Survey has done a number of comprehensive surveys for several years. What's shown here really is the estimate of the ultimate recoverable resource. And this is a resource. Resources are not reserves and they're not production. And I think that's a particularly important item when one gets into trying to understand the debate about what's going to happen to the production rate and is there a maximum in the production rate and so on. I'll talk about that in a minute. Estimates of this based on geological information have material uncertainties. If you look at 2000, the USGS 2000 survey, which is the most recent comprehensive survey, much of it based on data that is, of course, older than that, shows a mean estimated number of about 3 trillion barrels. Put that in perspective, the world's used a trillion barrels in the last 120 years. It will probably use another trillion in the next 20 to 30 at the kind of rates people are using it at. And the key question, and it's an important one, is how much is left out of this conventional resource base? And the range of uncertainty here is large. At the low end, the estimates are 2+ trillion, which means you're not far from the end of the tank on conventional resource. The higher end is more like 4. And certainly one of the key points we made in the study is it's really important to do another comprehensive survey and perhaps one that's more general. One of the new things, and you'll see in the blue bar here, that was done in 2000 is try to estimate what are called unconventional resources. These would be the Athabasca tar sands, the extra heavy oil, oil shales, all of these things, that some of which are coming online now, some of which could be a resource in the longer term. And this, these are, have even greater uncertainties. But as you'll see as we go on here, the production from unconventional resources is one of the key elements in looking out to projections of fuel production in 2030. One of the interesting aspects about oil is its concentration. And you hear much about this today. What you're seeing here is in a generalized way with the size of the barrels are the conventional oil resource base. It's highly concentrated, and as you produce out of it over the next 25 years, you can expect it to become more so. And there's a lot of discussion about the policy and economic security implications of this. What's interesting is that if you add the unconventional resources, they actually have quite a different distribution. And we think this is a fundamental importance, particularly to the United States, and that actually has, certainly along with Canada and the Canadian tar sands, the world's largest concentration of unconventional fossil fuels. This doesn't include coal. This would be tar sands, oil shales, and so forth. So there are implications that in the long run there is a resource to be converted potentially to fuel supply, but of course it has significant technical, financial, and environmental challenges to be solved. Let me talk about the shift gears here and talk about the production question. And as was noted, we decided not to produce another dot. What you see here is on the right are a range of forecasts. It includes the full range of forecasts that were produced by public groups such as EIA, and I'll come back to the reference case in a moment, but independent research groups that forecast supply from a range of sources. What we're seeing here is total liquids worldwide. What we decide in the study is not to produce another dot and decide that that's instead to look at all of these studies comprehensively, take them apart and say, why do you get a range of 80 million to 130 million barrels? What drives the assumptions around this? And I'll come back to those in a moment. The line on here is the EIA reference case, which, as Bill pointed out, ties directly to the demand data. In fact, the 2030 forecast point out there at about 116 million barrels is actually a demand forecasted number with the assumption that supply will meet that by some means. Other forecasts are built on supply alone without consideration for what the demand and really try to look at what will the system deliver, and that's part of the way you get the distribution. Let me illustrate that. This is a curve from the Association for the Study of Peak Oil from France, and it reflects the fact that in the study we took in all the data end-to-end and treated it all in the same way, trying to understand what drove projections, what drove this range of projections that you see, which shows a maximized point of delivery somewhere between 2010 and 2020. At the high end, that dot at the high end is actually a consultant group submitted data on a proprietary data. We also, in this study, uniquely collected information from the international oil companies. This was done in a black box way, in such a way that we could not identify which companies submitted what projections, but it was important because they could be aggregated and actually get a sense of where the international oil companies, who, of course, do this for a living and do it regularly, viewed the forecast to be. And that's the data point shown there at about 105 million barrels a day. We believe in the study it's significant that this number is below the reference forecasted demand numbers. We think that it reflects a view, although we could not assign it specifically, but clearly a view in which there is more risk and other dimensions into the system that will produce a lower estimated value, at least on an average basis. Recently, The IEA put out the medium-term forecast. This falls. This was for 2012. It falls in the middle of the forecasts we have. Obviously, the forecasts are quite convergent in that time frame because you know a lot about what's going on in the system. So what explains this range? There are several factors, and they're all of these factors are considered by all forecasters, and it's a question of how one addresses the uncertainties and the unknowns. One is, what's the decline rate of the existing production? This is a point of significant contention among different groups, and uncertainty given the fact that a lot of data that's needed on a global basis to understand this is not available. The second one is, how accurate are the reported identified reserves that could be developed and added to that production base? Third, what's the role of technology in enhancing the actual recovery, increasing the recovery rate as it has throughout history from existing reservoirs? Fourth, and a very important one, is what's the role of unconventional production? And I'll have some more about that when we discuss the next hard truth. Five, what's the exploration opportunity? That is, what actually is out there to be found and will access be provided to get to it? And then six, what is the rate of investment? Because timing has a great deal to do with this. It may be that some groups, for example, in the peak oil community, believe that unconventionals will be important. It's just going to take you way too long, and they'll come in on the back end of the system. Well, there are some indeed challenges, and I'll show you that when we get to the next truth. So the bottom line was we looked at all these projections, we tried to understand what drives them, and in fact, one could make as a sort of a general view of these data points that depending on the level, your level of conservatism about the risks associated in the system, you would drive yourself down from the top to the bottom of these forecasts. The next hard truth has to do with mitigating these risks. To mitigate these risks, expansion of all economic energy sources will be required. Coal, nuclear, biomass, and other renewables, and unconventional oil and gas. All of these sources face significant challenges: environmental, safety, political, economic, and importantly, and I'll make a comment about this later, infrastructure. What connects the source to the actual demand and consumption points. You're going to need all of it. I think there's a view that the numbers are so large, and I think that's one of the striking things about the system that many people don't understand, is how big the system is. Half a gallon of liquid fuel consumed for every human on Earth every day. That's today. Let me talk about the contribution of unconventionals, because this was a key element of the study. And it flowed through to recommendations specifically for U.S. actions. This is a forecast from the 207 EIA reference case, and what it shows is global production from what they are calling unconventionals, biofuels, oil sands, extra heavy oil like the Orinoco in Venezuela, coal to liquids, actually converting coal directly to fuel, and gas to liquids, converting particularly remote gas directly to diesel. A couple of key points on this. You go from today about 3 million barrels a day to something 9 to 10 million barrels a day over the next 23 years. That's the equivalent of adding the entirety of the U.S. production base in unconventionals. This is a significant growth rate. And, in fact, we would argue that looking at the kind of demand numbers that you saw and the kind of issues that may be confronting the conventional oil base, you might have to do much better, in which case this is going to be a significant challenge, a significant amount of capital, a significant technical problems, and, of course, major environmental issues, especially with respect to the heavier hydrocarbons. Final comment on infrastructure. We recognize that it isn't enough to just say you have the resources, even if they're developed, or you have the demand points, even though you have a sense of where the economies are growing. How do they connect? They connect through ships, pipelines, rail. They have manufacturing. We call it refining today for crude oil, but really in the future it's really manufacturing associated as you add new kinds of feedstock, biofuels, coal to liquids, gas to liquids, all these things. this whole system was actually, we realized, was integral to the study, and a comprehensive study was done to try to understand the things that drove infrastructure. And I think that's an important part of the report. Basically, most forecasts of supply or demand assume it just shows up. If you have a resource, infrastructure materializes. If you have a demand point, infrastructure materializes. Well, that sounds okay, except when you think that you're going to add the scale of energy production and maybe the diversification that would be have to be brought on with these unconventionals and biofuels and things like that, it's not clear how the infrastructure is actually going to be developed, and it's a massive investment. To put the time frame on it, EIA has estimated that the total energy system over these time frames will require $20 trillion, an enormous investment, and much of that will go to new infrastructure. So with that, I think we're, Frank, you're on to energy security.
Thanks. Energy security. John talked initially about slogans in the place of policy. This was one of the issues we thought we had to take on in terms of a slogan. When you read the study, you'll find that there are fact boxes throughout the report, energy independence, peak oil. But on the independent side, we thought that it's not only a bad idea the way that it's being conveyed, but in fact, it's unrealistic for the, in the foreseeable future. It's probably contrary to our foreign policy goals, and it's inconsistent with our treaty obligations. Having said that, there's ways to improve energy security by reducing demand, increasing supply of all forms of energy, conventional, non-conventional, and alternatives, and suppliers as well, and by managing the geopolitics. And when you see the recommendations laid out, that's kind of the strategy behind the general recommendations. On this, the geopolitics task force, we actually found and distilled down four main points, and then the idea that when you get to a carbon-constrained future, that's really the game changer. And when we talk about demand and you see the amount of fossil fuel that's used to serve global demand, you can understand how significant it is. But in terms of concentration, we also heard from the demand group, Bill has talked about how demand is growing, and the most forecasts show demand increasing by 50 to 60% in the forecast period out to 2030. Where the demand is coming from and what it's being used for is a change. And I'll show you in just a second, but the non-developed world, the non-OECD world, so that's developing emerging economies, take up an increasing portion of global energy demand. And the types of energy they're using is significant. As you look out further, non-OECD world is also the holder of most conventional resources. So they control demand going forward and increasingly control the resource base, which leads to this idea of a changing global energy map, changing rules of the game, new players, maybe new rules, and requiring new policies. There's a concentration issue on the map as well. Don talked about the idea of non-conventional and conventional fuels. If you look at conventional oil and gas, they're from a handful of places around the world as major resource bases, Russia and the Caspian, the Middle East, Africa, and then some of the non-conventionals, Canada and Venezuela. If you play that out with the demand centers are also geographically non-proximate supply centers, but they're concentrated throughout the world. This puts a bigger strain on distribution networks to make sure the delivery occurs. Moving 85 million barrels a day around the world each and every day is an enormous task. The resource endowment issue, and Don talked about this both in terms of conventional and unconventional, in the geopolitics group we came to the same conclusion, that the resource endowment is indeed enormous when you factor in conversion capability, that you can move coal and gas to liquids, that you have biofuels out there and you have conventional resources. But increasingly we're finding that it's the above-ground issues, access, commerciality, security, the environment, transportation, investment. These are the things that I think are going to drive the limitations on whether you can produce, convert, and deliver this fuel on a daily basis. We're also sure that this evolving market features new players with new agendas, and you can see it in Russia and Venezuela. You can also see it now in Kazakhstan with China. The role of the G8, for example, in 2015, 2020, markedly different from what we have now. With these new players and new leverage, we think that the rules are changing. You bring Russia and China into the WTO, you change the face of the WTO. And probably we're not prepared using the old paradigm to look at models on how we can actually manage this world and the geopolitics therein. So let's just start with demand. Bill showed you global demand increases on a global basis. This is just the non-OECD world. And in the 50 to 60% increase for the global basis, we find in the non-OECD world the forecasts project about a 70% increase. Fossil fuels, instead of making up 80%, make up 90% of demand, and coal is the king. So when you think about the resource endowment of China or India, and then you lay a carbon constraint on that, you can see how difficult it is to change to a non-fossil-based economy. This is one of Bill's slides. That's why it has the energy demand monikers. We moved it around. But it shows it used to be 60-40. The OECD world consumed about 60% of the energy. The non-OECD world had about 40. We're at parity right now. We're going to switch in about 2009 or 2010, and increasingly demand will come from the non-OECD countries. When you look at global oil trade, this plays back to the energy independence issue. Clearly, the United States is a benefit to the United States to be part of a global system. And this system has been built up over the last century in terms of infrastructure and investment. Exhibit A, to make that point, is the response after Katrina and Rita. If it wasn't for a global distribution system, when the United States lost production capacity for several months and refining capacity, we would have been in a deep hole. The situation for natural gas is very similar. And, in fact, when you project out demand in the non-OECD countries, issues like China's growth using natural gas demand or LNG shipments gets increasingly important. And when you start looking at the avenues or routes, we found vulnerability zones or choke points around the world. And today, half the world's oil that's moved in interregional train goes through a handful of choke points around the world. So new considerations for investment. Don talked about the above-ground challenges for investment. Typically, oil and gas companies, when they went into a country, looked at technological risk, economic risk, geologic risk, commercial risk, and then political risk. But increasingly now, we're forced to look at things like new alliances, who the players are, national oil companies, resource nationalism, energy equity issues, this idea of aversion to American foreign policy. You know, when I was with Pennzoil, we were in the Caspian 10, 15 years ago, it was an advantage to be an American company. That's probably not the case today. This global transformation is taking place. We've moved from a bipolar world to briefly a unipolar world and to more like a multipolar world going forward. The alliances are continually shifting, and the rules of the road are yet unknown. Go ahead, Rob.
Thanks, Frank. Good morning. So let me just highlight very quickly for you one of the things that we think differentiates this study from many of the others that have been done. And that is that we took and organized teams around each of the topics you see listed on this chart, and I won't read them all off. You can look at them. There were about 12 or 13 different topics. We organized diverse teams, including experts from the oil industry, from academia, from non-government organizations, and in some cases from other countries, around each of these topics, and asked them to look at, from a technical standpoint, what's possible within the time horizon we're talking about, which is 2030. So we asked them to look at what's technically feasible in, for example, oil shale in by 2010, by 2020, by 2030. Okay, what are the roadblocks? Are there regulatory issues? Are there technical challenges that have to be overcome? Who's doing the research? How much money is being spent on R&D on that particular subject? And who's doing it? And what breakthroughs are possible? Human resources. In many of these issues, many of these topics, one of the biggest issues that comes out is the fact that we face a real crunch in terms of the technical workforce that's going to implement some of these R&D breakthroughs. And I'll talk about that in a second. And finally, deployment issues. Who's going to deploy the technology? What's the role of the U.S. government in deployment? Are there issues outside the U.S. in deploying this technology? Okay. I just want to highlight, I won't go through the list again, but highlight that we looked at not only supply-side issues, but also demand-side issues, like energy efficiency of automobiles, for example. A team organized around that subject. It included people from General Motors, Toyota, Caterpillar, GE, University of Michigan, et cetera. Okay? So on the workforce, this is sort of what we call the transcending issue. The two things I'm going to talk to you about, workforce and carbon, sort of became highlighted as the study went on as transcending issues that affected what's likely to happen in the future and some of the forecasts that Don and Bill showed you. In fact, the energy sector workforce, especially scientists and engineers, but also including skilled labor, a majority of that workforce is eligible to retire within the next decade. Okay, so obviously, if we're going to expand the system, the workforce is going to have to be replenished and trained. I'll show you a graph that depicts that. This particular graph shows you the skilled workforce in the oil industry. It's a graph of age on the x-axis and percent of the workforce on the y-axis. So you see a big peak around 50 years of age. And inside that yellow shaded area, which is 45 years of age and older, half the workforce exists today. And that big bubble in the system are those people, the baby boomers that were hired in the late 70s, early 80s, that have come through the system, right? And then you had a period of decline, depressed activity in the U.S. in particular, and you see that trough that's in the mid-30s now, which is where you'd like to see a big part of your workforce. And you do see a little uptick at the back end of this today, but there are some real challenges with that, and not the least of which is the fact that the pool of people that we have available to us within the U.S. From U.S. universities is shrinking. The number of engineers and scientists graduating, particularly minorities and women, is way too small. And we're in competition with lots of other industries. And I don't want to make this as a unique problem for the oil industry, although it's quite acute for us. It's acute for the nuclear industry as well. I mean, it's actually probably worse in that industry. And it's also not unique to the U.S. We did look globally. The issue is particularly bad in North America and Western Europe, as you might expect. On carbon, again, this was an issue that sort of grew in importance as the study went on. And, in fact, during the time frame of the study, I would say positions kind of changed. You know, the world sort of changed on carbon in the last 18 months or so. And what we came down to was we said that the hard truth was that policies aimed at curbing carbon dioxide emissions will alter the energy mix that you just saw, which is heavily weighted towards fossil fuels, increase energy-related cost, and require reductions in demand growth. Okay, there are a lot of detailed recommendations. Adam will take you through some of them. But I think the hard truth that people have to understand here is that there is growing concern about climate and CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. This is not a localized problem. It's a global issue. Carbon dioxide mixes in the atmosphere globally. It's not something that any one geographic area is going to solve by itself. That makes it complicated, obviously. The time horizon you're talking about to work on this issue is long. This is not a short time frame phenomenon. You know, any change in climate that is related to carbon dioxide is related not to emissions, but actually concentrations in the atmosphere. So it's not your instantaneous emissions that affect climate. It's what's in the atmosphere. And the Earth's carbon cycle is a couple hundred years long. So this is not something you're going to change overnight, even if you dramatically changed emissions today, which you obviously can't do very dramatically either. And I guess the third thing I'd like to point out here, which is something that Don pointed out with respect to supply in general, and that is that there's an infrastructure required here if you are going to materially impact carbon dioxide emissions that is not trivial at all. And in fact, if you look at some of the numbers, you will very quickly be, if you're going to try to capture that carbon sequestered in deep in the earth, you're talking about an infrastructure and a level of investment that's not unlike the oil industry today. All right, so this is a huge issue from a time frame, from a geographic perspective, and from an investment perspective. And so our recommendations relate to the fact that this is a tough long-term challenge. So I'll leave it to Adam now to lead us through the strategies.
Well, you've heard a great deal now about the facts of the situation and the findings that the study team presented to the full National Petroleum Council. And what I'd like to do now is to go over the strategies that were recommended by the group and adopted by the NPC for addressing the situation that you've heard described. The five major sort of buckets, I think that we could call them, that were included in the strategy recommendations start with moderating the rate of demand increase in energy in the U.S. and globally. In the U.S., one of the key ways of accomplishing this was determined to be fuel economy standards for passenger vehicles and light trucks. By using existing technology that was looked at very carefully by a number of the subgroups on the committee, it was determined that some 3 to 5 million barrels a day of oil could be saved out to the year 2030 by taking a good hard look at fuel economy standards. On the residential and commercial building side, it was determined that something like 6 billion cubic feet a day of natural gas, that's some 10% of current gas consumption in the U.S., could probably be saved by tightening up residential and commercial building standards and looking at appliance efficiency standards as part of that. On the industrial side, across all of the fuels, oil, coal, and natural gas, it was determined that looking again at energy efficiency opportunities could probably save something like 4 to 7 quadrillion BTUs a year, and that's a significant proportion of total current consumption. The second major recommendation set has to do with expanding and diversifying U.S. energy supply. What are the issues here? As you heard from Don and others on the panel, the fossil fuel endowment in the U.S. and globally is really pretty large, but there are major questions that have been raised about this endowment and how quickly it could be delivered. So one of the major recommendations of the NPC is that the Secretary of Energy, working with the Secretary of the Interior, work on a national resource assessment to include all fuels, including biomass. One of the interesting opportunities that was determined on the biomass side is something like 4 million barrels a day of production potential exists there. But there are issues associated with things like water and land and so on that need to be looked at, and our recommendation is that that be done. The second key recommendation in the expansion and diversification bucket is that we need to do something very serious about moderating the decline in the existing production of oil and natural gas in the U.S., taking a good hard look at enhanced oil recovery and what could be done to slow down the decline in marginal wells in the U.S. And kind of a final idea in the oil and gas area is that it would be very important to continue to work to open up the areas in the United States that have high potential for oil and natural gas supply that are currently not accessible under regulatory rules. And finally, in this area, and again, looking at across the fuel set, the NPC determined that, not mine, the NPC determined that that the use and promotion of nuclear power in the U.S. will be very critical over the next 25 years. All right, how about in strengthening global and U.S. energy security? Well, Frank talked about this, but basically what we really need to do here is to integrate energy policy across trade, economic, environmental, and foreign policy development in the U.S. We cannot separate out energy policy from these other major issues. And in fact, one of our key conclusions is that that there is no U.S. energy security without global energy security, and continuing to emphasize the expansion of dialogue with other nations is critical, We need to promote a global and transparent energy marketplace and have good resource technology transfer. Yeah, I was just reminded that all of these, that some of these major conclusions on are the, on the other slides, but I was hoping to save just a little bit of time here at the end, Frank. Reinforce capabilities to meet new challenges. Assessing the infrastructure needs out to the year 2030 is something that's critical, not only for the U.S., but globally. Developing human resource issues is something that Rod brought up, and that is obviously a key recommendation of the NPC. We need to truly rebuild science and engineering capabilities in our graduate schools and perhaps even change some of the retirement rules so that this movement of the baby boomers through the employment time frame doesn't simply end in the use of the skill set that was built up over many years. Another key area in this capabilities to meet new challenges area is one of improving the quality of the data and the information that's available both in the U.S. and globally on energy. And a key recommendation is that the Secretary of Energy work very closely with governments all around the world to improve the quality of this data. So on the issue of carbon constraints, well, the main recommendation here is that there's really no clear legal and regulatory framework available for carbon capture and sequestration. If we are going to move down that track, we need to know as a nation, and certainly from the standpoint of the industry that's going to be required to do this, what the legal and regulatory requirements and conditions are. Access to federal lands could be a very important aspect of this. Demonstration projects could be something that will be very key in proving out the technology. And the idea of an effective global framework for doing this is also very critical. Carbon output knows no boundaries, and it's not. It would help, obviously, if any one particular country began to address these things, but having a global framework to do this is something that ultimately will be required in order to make really serious progress in doing this. So one other thing that is important in thinking about the issue of carbon constraints is, and you heard this from the other panelists, is that the likely growth in energy demand over the next 25 years is going to be very, very significant. Coal will play a huge and very important role in meeting demand for electricity in the U.S. and China over this time period, and the need for finding ways to enable the continued use of coal is something that the National Petroleum Council thinks is actually very important. And I think this goes back to the whole concept of what we were trying to do in this study, is that there is no single easy solution to all of this. We're going to need a lot of work on things like conservation, biomass, and coal, in addition to all of the work that you've heard over the years from the National Petroleum Council on the oil and gas side. So now what I'll do is not go through these, but just to let you know that on the National Petroleum Council website, in many, many places, are these key recommendations on demand moderation, expansion of supply, the promotion of global energy security, reinforcing these capabilities in science and engineering, and research and development opportunities, both in the U.S. and globally, and addressing carbon constraints. I don't see John Hamry, who we thought might want to do a quick summary of all of this, so let me just do it very, very quickly. Five strategies, you've heard them. Global cooperation is really going to be required, and this is has to be emphasized. And finally, we've got to begin now and work on this in a very determined and consistent basis to make this work. You know, how would this show up, for example, in a summary form in the U.S. in terms of the demand for liquid fuels, oil, and NGLs? The track that you see here is the basic EIA reference case for oil demand out to the year 2030. Down at the bottom of this graph, you see the U.S. liquid fuels production profile. Those dotted lines show the decline curve that's likely to happen if we don't make some changes, and how, with some attention to marginal wells and enhanced oil recovery, we could begin to actually lift U.S. liquid fuels production. In addition to that, we could expand and diversify some of the opportunities domestically available in the areas such as biomass and tar sands and so on. And finally, we could moderate the demand growth, and you see that at the top. The conclusion then would be that global trade or net oil imports could actually shrink a little bit. It's not going to go away. The idea of energy independence, where the U.S. is completely free of whatever needs we might have on the global system, it is a mirage. It can't be done in the time frame and at the kind of costs that we think would be acceptable to the American public. But there are ways to moderate demand, increase supplies, and expand and diversify those that would tend to limit some of the need for imports that would help somewhat on the security side. So now with that, and this little advertisement that tells you where to find all of the details and on the NPC website, let me turn it back to Frank, and he can host the question period. Thanks, Frank.
Thanks very much. Two quick things. Thank you for your patience, for one. Every time we do this, it winds up being an hour, no matter how many slides we have. There's a lot of detail in this report, and I would urge you all. The website has downloaded something like 250,000 copies of the report to date, so there's a lot of information out there. As you comb through it and read, there's a comment and a questionnaire on the NPC website. You're encouraged, actually, to file questions or comments. We have two rules here in terms of questions here. We will post these slides, by the way, on the NPC or on the CSIS website either later today or first thing tomorrow. In terms of questions, and we know there's probably a lot of them, we only have two simple rules here. One is that you identify yourself, wait for a microphone, and then to the extent you can, pose your question in the form of your question. It would really be appreciated. So without further ado, let me go ahead and take some questions here. We'll start. Go ahead, in the back. Next to a microphone. Thank nicely you. Done.
Rob Bradley, World Resources Institute. Thanks very much. I mean, there's an enormous body of work here, but there seem to be a couple of issues that we skirted.
Rob, you're going to have to speak up.
Hello?
There you go.
Okay. There's within all of the richness of the areas you've been covering here, there are a couple of pieces that seem to be a little bit skirted around, and I appreciate that we're giving a pretty brief précis of what is a very detailed body of work. One is that there seem to be action points for almost everybody except some of the industries that we've been talking about here. So, for instance, talking about needing to look, quote, more closely at enhanced oil recovery. Now, I've no doubt that Secretary Bodman is an extremely clever man, but it seems unlikely that he's going to be able to take a better look at it than some of the companies that we've got represented on this panel. So what specifically does it mean to call for a sort of public action along those lines? Surely this is something that, given oil prices where they are today, the industry ought to be picking up pretty effectively itself. The second point is really around, the second question is around carbon. Again, carbon capture and storage, there are some technical issues to be dealt with. WRI is actually convening a process in which many of you are partners to try and define some of the federal rules and so forth. But ultimately, none of those mean the slightest thing without some kind of carbon price that's going to drive it. As we're seeing in Europe, in fact, once that carbon price is in place, turns out a lot of these technical and regulatory barriers are not that challenging. So although we've skirted around that issue a bit, if you're thinking of carbon capture and storage, does that not suggest that you're effectively endorsing a carbon price and or mandate somewhere in the fairly near future?
Okay, thanks. Why don't we turn, Don, why don't you take on the supply?
Yeah, the specific issue on EOR is actually directed at the nature of the onshore lower 48 U.S. issue, in which you have you've had a very changing ownership structure in the U.S. that makes it complex. And also the U.S., you know, it's 1 million barrels a day from wells that average 2 barrels a day per well. The ability, in our view, that the U.S. cannot afford to lose this part of the production system. And so it's a complex issue. It's not like the major oil companies that are going to do whatever they need to do for large fields. It's really the U.S., special case U.S., which is it's a very mature development, hundreds of thousands of wells, and they don't add up to much each, but when you add them all up, they're 1 million barrels a day, and preserving that system probably requires a more sophisticated, in fact, historically has been supported technically by programs at the DOE, which we felt needs to be done. So it is a very specific recommendation directed at the U.S. in particular. And
Roger, Carmen.
Okay, so on carbon, first off, I would respectfully disagree with your assertion that we skirted the carbon issue. I think we covered it in a lot of detail. There's probably, between the working papers and the summary report, there's probably on the order of, you know, 100 pages in gory detail about what's technically possible, what regulations are missing. And I agree with you that once a structure is put in place, including some incentive to capture the carbon, like a price or a cost to it, then a lot of these issues go away, and particularly on the technical side. We think on the technical side, and that's laid out in some detail in the report, in general, we know how to do it. So, you know, while I may have sounded a little bit pessimistic before that this is a big problem and unprecedented and so forth, at the same time, we think it's something we can take on. But there are some regulatory issues that have to be sorted out first, and I don't think they're insurmountable. They've been done before in the offshore or in storing natural gas, but there are some things that have to be put in place first. And then with regards to cost or a price, I mean, we didn't think it was our job to lay out what that ought to be, but we do point out in the report that it has to be something that is viable for the long term, is high enough that it causes an actual reaction in the market, and then some of the pros and cons of a cap and trade versus a tax versus some kind of direct regulatory issue are laid out in the report. We didn't think it's beyond our pay grade to pick one, but we tried to lay out what the issues are.
If I could just add one comment, it's very important in the report. The report really focuses on the how-to question, and particularly with respect to carbon capture and sequestration for the U.S. The U.S. is a special case, distinctly different from Europe in some regards because of coal, if nothing else. U.S. is the largest reserve holder, a major producer, second after China, and solving the carbon capture problem at scale to deal with coal is an issue particularly for the U.S. carbon management structure that arguably is not the same as for Europe. It is the same for China.
Okay, Jim.
Just one thing, and I think just from listening, that one thing that's very, very important when you say not so much pessimism, but an appreciation for the scale, the size of dealing with, for instance, capturing carbon from the coal industry, finding that's out there is just, I think, is underappreciated the magnitude of that, just the challenge of implementing that. When you look at a system that it may be as large as our existing natural gas system to move natural gas may be necessary to move carbon. So,
the good news, though, is since the U.S. is the largest historical producer of oil and gas, it actually has a lot of pore space. And that's significant. In fact, the U.S. has by far the largest pore space resource of any country in the world.
Okay. We're going to come across the front here, so we'll start right here and then move across.
I'm Bud McFarland. You passed over the requirement for all of us to focus more on energy security. And when you look specifically in the report on the vulnerability of existing supply, infrastructure, and production, how would you characterize, for example, your confidence is high, worried, low about the security of Persian Gulf oil and gas terminals?
This is something we grappled with, and I'll ask my colleagues to respond to this as well. We took a 30-year time frame to kind of go out and look at major trends, so perturbations, short-term, we tended to stay away from. Issues like concentration and deliverability, these are the above-ground issues. I think we all agree that we segmented, when we dealt with the issue of peak oil, for example, we segmented the resource endowment from what it actually takes to produce it, convert it, and get it to where you need it. So it's not only supply routes, but it's actually the on-the-ground security, and that's increasingly important. The two forecasts, since we didn't do a forecast of our own, if you look at the EIA and the IEA forecast, and this is kind of important because one group actually looks at additional supply coming from non-OECD countries. The other, actually, the EIA, says that there's a limitation on what we can expect from the Persian Gulf just based on production profiles, investment, and what they've announced that they're intending to do. The IEA, on the other hand, says, well, we actually think that the Persian Gulf, look at the resource base, it's the largest resource base there. We're increasingly going to turn to that when you look at additional supply sources. The idea of the way we've approached the above ground, and most of our recommendations are U.S.-centric, there's a common misperception, and I know you don't have it, Bud, but there's a common misperception here about how much the U.S. relies on the Middle East. And in a global marketplace, the Middle East is indeed important, but it's still about 60-40 OPEC, non-OPEC. As you go forward, the concentration, given the resource endowment, increasing supplies will come from the OPEC countries and from the Middle East, which has the largest endowment, unless some things change. So the way we approach it is to reduce demand. You have to moderate the demand, because unless you change the curve of demand, you're constantly chasing this elusive, you know, future demand growth, and you just can't get there. Clearly, you can't get there. And beyond the forecast period, this idea of unsustainability, 2040, 2050, at these growth rates, kind of hard to imagine where you're going to pick up 80 million barrels of new supply. You have to complement that with additional supply sources. Rod and Don talked about, you know, how coal in the United States, we have to find a way to viably continue production and use of coal. With a carbon-constrained environment, some ways you look at technology, you look at conversion capability, looking at natural gas, looking at renewables. So we have to change the scheme of it. But the whole piece of security and geopolitics also comes into play. If you look at the way that the ground rules are kind of shifting and the supply routes are shifting and who has leverage, we need a plan B. And most of the things that have happened in this town have been kind of plan A and hoping for the best. So we didn't go into it in the level of detail that would probably meet your needs, but we thought that we needed to at least elevate the debate around here and put some things on the table, recognizing that we have 200-odd members in the Petroleum Council, so it's a consensus document. Any other comments you want to make on that? Okay. Go ahead.
My name's Martin Apple. I'm from the Council of Scientific Society Presidents. It's a group that represents 150 scientific disciplines and 1.5 million scientists. One other way to look at the picture of American energy supply would be to look at the entire panoply of where all the energy comes from, how it's used, and where it ends up. If we do that, we find that about a quarter of the energy comes from petroleum into the United States. We find that the creation of two major uses of energy, which are electricity and transportation. Electricity accounts for about 35% of the total use of energy, transportation about 25 to 30%. If we divide where these the amount of energy coming in out of versus the amount of energy we actually use, that is, we capture, we see that in electricity, we lose a clear majority, about 50 or 60% of all the electricity that we create gets lost in transmission. If we look at the energy supply and transportation, about 80% or more gets lost in heat and other inefficiencies. We only capture 5 or 6% to actually move vehicles. So if we look at the target that we ought to be doing strategically for long-term solution, we should be looking at distribution of energy supplies, electricity, so that we don't have long transmissions. And we should be looking at, we have to focus on increasing the efficiency of the use of the energy that we put into the transportation system. If we can do these two things, either one, we totally negate the need for coal as a supply, and we totally negate the need for importing oil, because we increase our effectiveness in using the energy sufficiently.
Was that a question?
The question is, in terms of strategic look, why not use these strategic approaches, which have granted a re-looking at the whole picture of how we use energy, as opposed to trying to tune the systems that we have now?
Well, remember that the purpose of the study was to look at all forecasts, not make a new one. And there are forecasts that call for a radical restructuring of the energy system, Greenpeace forecast, for example. So maybe we can talk about what, and I know, Rod, in the technology, you can look at what one would view would be radical alterations. I think when we look at the overall issue of not just environmental performance or security performance, but you actually look at economics, and one looks at how economic systems and how investments might get you from where you are today to where you are then, one has to think. For example, in coal, the issue is coal plants are going to be built. China's going to build 500 of them. It would seem that fixing coal would be pretty critical path, or it doesn't matter very much what the United States does. So we tried to take a look at the system that says there are more opportunities on the edges of capability, and particularly with materially altered rules, which I think is what you're talking about. But we also had to look at those things which were likely to come about, and how do you make those drive toward a system that gives you the best chance across a broad front. And so what we said in the thing is, you don't know how this is going to play, and betting on one solution pathway is probably too high risk to reflect the world the way it's going to evolve. So have a portfolio of approaches, and that's kind of where it comes. Rod, do you have any comment about that in terms of these other technical solutions?
Well, I think just two comments. Number one is that, you know, I think it's significant that our number one recommendation is on efficiency of energy, which, so we agree with you that that's a big potential savings for the U.S. And in fact, Adam listed out some of the numbers. They're big numbers. You know, I mean, 5 million barrels a day on automobile efficiency is a big, big number. So there's no doubt there's a lot of room there for improvement. There's no question about that. I just would point out that one has to keep in mind the time frame of actually changing over some of these things. You take automobiles, for example. Even if you change the fuel economy of a new car in 2008, the time to change over the fleet is still 12 to 15 years. So it's not something that's going to have an immediate impact. These are things that take time to change over. That's the only thing you'd have to consider. There's not only a technical development time constant, if you like. There's then the deployment time constant and the adoption time constant that people often forget about.
Yeah, I was going to emphasize the scale and timeline. Bill, do you want to comment on the power generation transmission? Because you all looked at that in demand.
Yeah, and the issue of power generation is a vexing issue. Largely, as consumers, we like to use electricity. Liking to use electricity, it requires that you produce it somewhere and some place. One of the things that's gone on in the United States, particularly in recent years, is move away from coal power generation, not away from, but the increase in power generation has been in large measure gas, combined cycle gas, which is a major step in efficiency improvement in generating electricity. It is also a very good way to produce more electricity with fewer emissions of carbon dioxide and other things. However, because of the available supply of natural gas in the U.S., it then becomes an issue of how do you continue to supply more and more gas for power generation versus other uses like heating in the residential and commercial areas, as well as a major consumer as feedstock in industrial processes. I agree with you. It is a system issue, and it is not easily solved. Getting back to a comment, I guess that Rod made as far as electricity is concerned, most of these plants have effective economic lives of 40 and 50 years. So replacing them quickly, even if there was a new technology, would be a very difficult thing to do. Not that it should not be sought after and tried for, but we all need to realize that changing the demand side is a very, very slow process. The inertia is just overwhelming. And I think those of us that are familiar with the idea of inertia realize that changing something dramatically is not going to happen.
Just one comment, and I think it's a really runs through the thread of the report. It was probably one of the important things that all this diversity that was brought together on the study, and that is when people say, "Well, you know, we have to build renewables as fast as we can." We agree. We have to keep coal going. This is like from the coal people. We agree. The point is you're going to need every molecule and every electron. And the concept that my solution is the solution and I'm going to replace you, I think, is unrealistic. And one of the challenges with renewable is the scale problem. You know, there has been proposals in the paper to build the largest commercial solar plant in the world, actually, 80-megawatt plant. It takes a square mile of silicon in California. Put it in perspective, that's the same amount of energy that's generated from one good gas well. So it's the scale and the density is a problem. So we're just saying, do them all. And how do you keep them all going down the line? Because you're going to need all of them. That's really where we're coming from.
Philip Hughes with the White House Writers Group. I have a much less encompassing question following on the point Mr. Nelson made about fleet renewal in the vehicle and transportation fleet. In the presentation, you made reference to some pretty dramatic savings in moderating demand in natural gas consumption by tightening building standards. Trying to recall what the other recommendation in that rubric was, but basically tightening building standards and appliance efficiency. But there's also a kind of a fleet problem there, too. I mean, the installed capacity in buildings turns over vastly less quickly than the fleet of vehicles. So could you tell us a little bit more about what you're imagining there in terms of being able to generate those kinds of efficiencies? What sorts of investments on a residential and a commercial scale we're thinking about here? That looks like an awful lot to bite off to achieve those savings.
Yeah, Bill and Rod, go ahead.
Yeah. Actually, the issue you raised is a very valid issue, and that was a part of the residential commercial question that was addressed. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which side of the coin you happen to live, the structures that we're talking about have lives of something like 80 years, and I think this is what you are referring to. So dealing with the existing structure is a real challenge. However, there are certain things that can be replaced in real structures that have significant impacts on energy consumption. Windows can be replaced. Any aperture can be improved. This is not without cost, but that can happen. As we go forward, unfortunately for the other people, the thing on the other side of the coin is that things like heating systems and cooling systems wear out. And you replace, as you replace those, you can replace those with more efficient facilities. The same is true with appliances, which, of course, have a much shorter life And that gets back to the earlier question on electricity, because a lot of those are electrical consumers. Establishing a set of standards that allow only the most effective, and I say effective because it's a combination of technical issues as well as economic issues, those to be used in the replacement factor. The net is, and I'm trying to remember now, but the net effect was something like 15%, which is a sizable number. Getting back to the gentleman in the front row, a large part of that is electricity. So when you save a BTU in a residential or commercial sector, you save really three BTUs for generating electricity. So it has a big multiplier effect. And that's in the number that we have talked about. And then going forward, as we build new structures, there is a lot to be gained by putting in place truly effective standards on new buildings.
Okay, Rod, did you have anything to add?
I'll make a general comment. It applies to, you know, the automobiles and the appliances and the buildings. You point out that you know, there are some big deployment issues, but when we looked at it from a technical point of view of what's possible, what we found generally and almost across the board was that there is a lot more scope technically to improve the energy efficiency, whether it's automobiles, refrigerators, air conditioner units, than what's demanded by the regulations. And so what we're recommending is that not only are regulations updated to take advantage of what technology available now, but that you have to, unlike what's been done in the past, you have to continually, over this time frame, update those regulations, and then you'll achieve those kind of savings. If you just do starts and stops, you won't achieve it.
One other thing that sort of borders on where you're coming from is as we become clever and provide more products for consumers to use, we often don't provide a set of standards, energy standards, efficiency standards, for those devices to meet. So we get large consumption of energy out there for which there is no standard. There are no regulations. And these things need to be considered, and those need to be put in place, which is really a situation of monitoring what's going on as we move forward as a modern society. And while we're talking about the U.S., this becomes a far greater issue when you're in a developing world. The growth potential is just so much more.
You know, a specific example is this one of the single most rapidly growing demand points or demand applications is for digital devices of all kinds. And, in fact, one looks at some of the server farm constructions and supercomputer centers, and you're talking about centers that require 100 megawatts to drive these. So there are no standards in this area. You're now starting to see computer manufacturing saying, well, now we're producing a much more efficient laptop. Good for you. But this has never been that's an example of something just absent. And it really fits with what Rod says, keep the standards up and keep them advancing.
And some are federal and some are state, which is another issue. Let me go to Bob Ebel here, and then we'll swing back on that side.
My name is Bob Ebel, and I'm from CSIS. I've got two crystal balls on my office desk. One is for the pessimist, and one is for the optimist. And which one you look into in the morning determines how your day is going to go. This morning, I happened to look at the pessimist. So my question is pessimistic. Question is very simple. Now what? You've submitted a report to the Secretary of Energy. What does he do with it? Does anything happen until after the new administration comes to town?
Okay, we have to replace the ball on your desk to start with. We're going to start with Jim.
Or does it just gather dust until they decide to take a look at it?
Jim,
I looked around with my my companions up here. They're all looking my way. I tell you, the report, I can say of all the different reports I've been in, this is so far gathered less dust just during the rollout operation. But let me kind of first, I think would be appropriate to kind of give you a little sense of the department's involvement and appreciation for this work. Because the NPC is a federal advisor committee, the department, and it also, in addition to the normal federal advisor committee, has some history, because while now there's a fairly diverse membership, it historically still has a very significant representation from the oil and gas community, so there's a whole set of antitrust issues. So the department is involved. There's a series of co-chair requirements that government has to be at every meeting and things like that. So we're involved in this process, available to answer questions. Is this what the secretary is looking for? And throughout the process, the scope of work, the diversity that was involved, and the level of effort that went into this, the department is very enthusiastic that it is more significant than many other products that are out there. That it truly deserves to inform the energy debate. And what I think one of the best ways to go, if you look at the Secretary's comments on at the National Petroleum Council meeting where the report was presented to him, was an enthusiastic endorsement of the process, level of effort, and this embracing the amount of work that are going into that. From the department standpoint, we clearly think that the findings, the understandings deserve to be used in formulating policy, not just in this in the United States, but we think they're useful around the world. And the Secretary had throughout this early in the process wrote letters to 19 countries to solicit information and participation in the study, and now we'll be going out back to at least 19 countries to present that information in various forums. So we embrace the report. When you get down into, and the strategies, the specific recommendations, we're actively going through those now. I think one of the things you look at that is also, I think, a difference on this and very valuable, even if you, as you evaluate the details of the recommendations, there's going to be great agreement in the underlying issue that you're going to try to solve. Having a robust and effective petroleum engineering and geosciences program in this country, I think everybody would agree with. There may be some differences in how you get there, but we are actively looking at those recommendations. We're actively engaged in the rollout and communication education process. That's why I'm here. Other members of the department are involved. Our Clay Sell, our deputy secretary, was actively involved in the process and is actively involved in discussing the results of the report. So we hope it doesn't gather dust. The department is very much engaged in supporting the use of this as, I think the phrase we use is informing the energy debate, and we think it's a great time. In 2005, when the secretary asked for this report, if you part of the issue is you go back and say, what was the state of mind, the reference on that? There were, of course, that was shortly after we were dealing. We were a few months, we actually formally did the request a few months after the hurricanes that hit. And we, of course, have been talking about it prior to that. There's references back a couple months before that. But that, of course, concern over energy investment. There was beginning to see this increases in costs of major energy projects around the world and what impact that was going to have. So, and then for this, but we did not anticipate it rolling out while there was a robust discussion of energy legislation. And yet I think the timing is perfect to have this kind of good, analytically based piece of work out there for that. And I've probably gone on a bit long on that, but I want to communicate that we fully embrace the work that the National Petroleum Council has done. And I think the Secretary's words at the rollout were that this report is more than I expected.
I think we've all been pleasantly surprised at the Hill response, too. There have been a number of briefings on committee staff that have been pretty well attended, And there's been follow-up requests. I know Rod did a technology session for a couple hours. We went up and did geopolitics on a separate basis. So I think that's going to go forward. Having said that, I think we all recognize that we're in the throes of a political season. But this didn't happen overnight. It's not going to be solved with one piece of legislation. So we want to elevate the debate and better inform going forward. Go ahead.
Adam Siegel, Energy Consensus. A point and then a question. The point, and this is throughout the report. I haven't read the whole report. But I've seen it, and I think you're well aware of it. When we speak about cost, for example, on energy efficiency, we really should be talking about total cost. For example, I think there was a study in Florida that said 15% cut in energy electricity use for total, even with growth in the next 7 years, and an average cost of 4 cents a kilowatt. That's pretty cheap. I mean, the whole Rocky Mountain Institute and megawatts. So when the comment is cost, yes, there's a upfront purchase costs, but if we start to think about total operating costs, total ownership costs, it frequently the megawatt is much cheaper. And so just reinforcing in a different way. That's in the report. My question is, when I'm flipping through it, haven't finished it by any means yet, and I haven't seen the discs, I constantly am asking myself, how would this be different if it were the American Wind Energy Association or the Nuclear Energy Association or a different group, Rocky Mountain Institute, as the chair, rather than it being the National Petroleum Council? And I haven't seen it yet. I don't know how much in the technology or otherwise, where there are outlying scenarios, perhaps questions saying, what if there's $20 trillion? What if in the next 15 years we decide to put a trillion into ocean energy and wind technologies? What if we truly tried to push some of the alternatives, if we tried to face the hard truth in a different way?
Okay. Don?
Well, I'll just make a couple of comments. First off, I think if you look at the membership roster of a lot of these studies, and they're in there, I mean, we had a very diverse group of people involved. So I think that's one issue. And we looked at studies, and including studies from groups that have an entirely different view than certainly people would think the traditional petroleum industry. I think that one of the challenges you have with energy infrastructure is when people say, why don't we? I guess one of the questions that the economists would say, well, who is we? Is it the owners of the utilities? Is it the owners of the resources? Is it the consumers? Is it governments? I think one of the challenges is how do you evolve the energy system? You don't start from scratch. You have something that you've built for 100 years. And so one of the key questions about how do you evolve it is not just what are the technical outcomes, but what are the economic models and the investment patterns and all of these kinds of things. For example, renewables, as you correctly point out, have an entirely different investment structure than the traditional utilities, where you have to pay more capital at the beginning and then you have very low operating expenses on the back end. Depending who's doing the calculation, you result in a different net present value than you would as if you have lower capital at the beginning and pay operating expenses down the line. So we're saying, we talk about financing and macroeconomics, right, in the study as well. So I think all we're saying is we looked at all these studies trying to understand the different perspectives as opposed to produce our own forecast. We come back to where we are, push on all fronts, because you don't know how this is going to play out.
Okay. Let me just say, I know we've gone a little bit over, but because on our presentation side we also went over, let me take three more questions. We'll kind of lump them together and then put them forward to the panel. So we'll start in the back, we'll come to the front, and go over the side, and then that'll wrap it. Go ahead.
Ken Austin, Treasury Department. One thing about strategies is they're not only about what you do, it's about what you've agreed you don't have the resources not to do. Has this study identified any things that are not worth doing or that we shouldn't do?
Okay. All right.
Andy Patterson with Econergy. We're in the private equity space and carbon management. The question is, which investment model? Yes, we need lots of investment. The Southeast says we need a risk-adjusted regulated return model. We don't want the California model, which is based on market pricing, which was a spectacular failure with IPPs. You might get a hybrid investment model like we're trying to do with the natural gas pipeline that Jim Sluts is working on, where you're not going to market price an $18 billion pipeline. You need a loan guarantee and a price floor. That's a hybrid model. You can't just depend on market pricing to get that kind of energy infrastructure built. So market pricing investment model doesn't work in a lot of the space. And so the question of the group is, which investment model, consider the Southeast model as an alternative, should we use going forward to choose all these options and get them financed?
Okay. We're going to lump them together, and then we'll just respond. Ahead. All right.
And then one more question.
Yeah, and we'll come back on that side.
Sarah Mincheski, the Center for Naval Analysis. You all mentioned a list of limiting factors, and not included on that list was water. I was wondering if this report addresses water as a limiting factor, and especially as we see that the United States has the biggest supply of unconventional fuels and how that's so much more water intensive.
Okay, thank you.
Avery Cohn, United Nations Foundation. And one other question. Notice that a lot of the increase in energy demand comes from transportation, and as you guys well know, a lot of that needs to be satisfied with liquid fuels. And I'm wondering what, if any, studies there have been to look at how some of that increased demand in liquid fuels can be dampened with electricity.
Okay. Go ahead, Don.
Take on the water question, because we've had that before in other groups. It's an excellent question. And remember, again, our goal here was to understand what people forecasted and what are the assumptions. And I think I would argue that water, like other infrastructure type issues, is probably underrepresented in most forecasting scenarios. And yet one would argue with things like biofuels that clearly take significant amounts of water, as do other unconventional production. So I think that that's something that we saw in the forecasts, and is probably viewed as something that's not as well understood by most energy forecasters.
Brad, you come in.
Well, I would just say in the water that's a very good point, and we point out in a couple of the subtopic papers on things like biofuels or oil shales, and in fact, fresh water might be the limiting factor when you get out to 2030 or so. That might be the biggest issue. So, okay. Maybe Adam wants to talk about investment.
Now let me try to tackle the investment issue of model. What we should not do.
Okay.
And,
hey, it saved you.
And what we should
model.
Avoid. Maybe I'll speak on my own behalf rather than the National Petroleum Council's here, but I think that we need a more realistic view of what the problems are and how they need to be addressed. And on the positive side, for example, Senator Bingaman, chairman of the Senate Energy Committee staff, put together a kind of a spreadsheet that showed the National Petroleum Council recommendations and what the Energy Committee has under consideration, and I think that's a hugely positive move in the sense of this issue, as Jim Sloot said, trying to inform the debate and move things towards practical solutions. In terms of things to avoid, price gouging legislation, on gasoline. I mean, now I'm speaking on my behalf. That's just silly. That is not going to solve the issues that we have in energy, production and distribution in the United States. In fact, it's probably counterproductive. And I'm glad I can say that on my own behalf, because I think there are things like that the National Petroleum Council probably has to avoid. But I think if you just look at what the National Petroleum Council is saying, and again, again and again and again in this study, what was being emphasized is you need to do it all, as much as you can. Everything that's economic, that makes sense and that can be enhanced through, the federal R&D efforts and so on. And we need to get going, not tomorrow, yesterday. We needed to start yesterday, and we need to sustain this effort over a very long period of time. This is not a flash in the pan issue that can be solved very quickly. It's going to require an enormous political will sustained over the next 20 years to solve these issues.
Do you want to talk about investment model? What we got you?
Well, investment models, right. I think the answer to that one is that we don't have any specific recommendations on what the proper investment model is. I mean, the companies can figure that out. I think that what we need as a nation is the right regulatory framework to be able to move forward on these things. And I think that's starting to happen. I mean, I think people are beginning to get much more serious about these issues, and we're seeing these issues being tackled from a legislative standpoint. That's great. That's good.
Just to maybe build a little on what Adam said, I think that with the diversification of the energy system, which in fact is underway, that there will probably be increased diversification about the financial and economic structures as well that fit. I think that that's probably going to be the case. And so I think all we're saying is that given the time frame that you're looking at, it's very difficult to sit today and make a prediction about what's actually going to happen in 25 years. I mean, you have trends, and we tried to identify them. But one of the reasons we said it's important to go across this whole portfolio of activities is because there is uncertainty about the outcomes of any given one pathway. And if you start eliminating pathways, just like in your financial portfolio, you start raising the risk on the pathways you have left for success. So I think that that'll mean diversification. In my view, diversification of the energy sources will probably enable diversified and be enabled by diversified financial structures as well.
I'll just add a couple points, and that I think just emphasize things that have been said. But regarding what we should not do, I think one of the things that we need to move away from in Washington is we tend to what's our favorite solution, or we in order to solve this, you know, we're going something else is there's a winner and a loser. I think this is everybody there's winners out here, and we got to stop beating up on different energy sources, but really look at. And then from a government standpoint, is the markets probably is the best place for those kind of issues to get worked out, but acknowledge that it is a challenge. These long lead time investment requires consistency in policy actions. We can't be changing it. When it takes to bring a new pipeline, you know, the reference was to the Alaska pipeline, which is probably far more than a $20 billion project now, and will take 10 years to build. You can't change the tax and regulatory structure every 2 years and expect people to be able to make investment decisions. And these projects are huge investments, and so we need to have a consistent investment environment. And I think that's just one example, but that applies all across the energy sector.
Okay. Let me just add one thing on the electricity versus liquid fuels on cars. I think we're going to need a diversity of approaches. I mean, even E85 in Iowa probably works nationwide, probably doesn't make a lot of sense. It seems to me, and sometimes we're caught between technologies, we may get a lot of stranded investment because the technology is moving so fast. There's simple digesters and biorefineries that can make methanol and ethanol, but they don't make biobutanol yet. And you can put that in pipelines. When you look at the electricity system, we talked about the efficiency. If it's 3 units of primary energy, 3.5 to get 1 unit of electricity out the back end, that may not be the most efficient way to distribute transportation energy. And then you have reliability and then the choice of fuels. If it's natural gas, you're reducing import dependence on oil and replacing it with natural gas. If it's coal, what's the footprint? If it's nuclear, we need to engage in that debate. So there's some serious discussion going on. I would also add to Jim's point, this idea of cherry picking. Adam talked about the spreadsheet on Capitol Hill. It's really helpful that some of these ideas are being proposed. One of the universal themes that we try to get out was this kind of strategy of doing supply, demand, efficiency, geopolitics, technology together. And the tendency around this town is to cherry pick and say, on page 32, they talk about efficiency. We like that. And then the rest gets left behind. So if you're going to tackle this problem, you really have to make some inroads. We talked about tonal quality of the report, try to get to the point of a sense of urgency while not being alarmist. We're somewhere in the middle. So it didn't please a lot of people. There was folks that thought that we needed to beat the drum a little harder and get things going faster. There's other people that said, you're kind of upsetting the apple cart. We think if the number of people are upset with the tone we took, it's probably the right tone. With that point, let me just say that there's a number of other issues that we could spend an entire day on talking about this. We would urge you to read the report. It's probably not as good as Harry Potter, but their illustrations are pretty exceptional inside. There will be a CD-ROM, a disk that will be distributed by the National Petroleum Council. You can download the entire report. You can download the executive summary. The summary, in our views, while it's really helpful as stage setting, you really need to get into the meat of the report and start pulling out the findings and read what's behind them, because a lot of time was spent on that, and I would urge you to do that. Don, you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I think that we've talked a lot here about policy implications, and that's natural in this environment. But it's important to realize that when we set out to do the report, we all agreed nobody's to talk about a recommendation, nobody's to talk about a policy until we do the study. And I think what resulted was very important, because the report, basically, 95% of the report is the study of the global energy system to 2030 and a look at all of these studies and all of these factors and the interrelationships. I think that's the power of the report, because any organization can derive strategic implications from that. Then we did have to focus down and deliver the goods to the Secretary of Energy with respect to specific recommendations. So I would say for those that the body of the report is really an attempt to try to understand the data that's out there and put it together with respect to the global energy system of demand, supply, technology, and politics.
Okay. Thank you so much for your patience. I know this is a long presentation. Carmen, if you want to come up here after, we'll try to address your question. But please join me in thanking the panel. This is an enormous amount of work. Thank you.